Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Coding 101 is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Coding 101 is brought to you by DigitalOcean. Simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. Deploy an SSD cloud server in 55 seconds. Try it today for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com, and once you sign up, be sure to enter the promo code C101 in the billing section for a $10 credit. And by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for the right payments API, check out the Braintree V.0 SDK. With one simple integration, you get every way to pay. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/coding. On this episode of Coding 101, it's another wild card episode. This time, it's Hanging with the Geeks and Patrick Delahanty. Hello and welcome to Coding 101. It's the show where we let you into the wonderful world of the code monkey, the code warrior. I'm Father Robert Ballas there, and joining me today, as always, is my super, I'm just going to call him Ant-Man co-host, Mr. Lou Maresca, a senior software developer for Microsoft. Lou, great to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me back. You made it sound like Patrick wasn't a geek there.
We're going to introduce him as a geek, but you just spoiled the surprise. So we might as well just go to the wide shot. That's right, folks. It's Patrick Delahanty from Adequate.com, from TWiT TV. Yeah,
from here. I spend most of my time here.
The wild card episodes are a chance for us to sort of step back from the code, step back from the modules, be it whatever language we're looking at. In fact, we just did an iOS module, and just speak to the people who live, breathe, deal with coding, programming every single day. So, of course, Patrick is one of my favorites because he's also the master of the TWiT API, which we will be doing in just a few weeks. Yes, there he is. That's how Patrick normally looks when he's working in his office.
That's my reaction to the API.
Patrick and me. Thank you.
Thanks.
Patrick, thank you very much for taking the time. You didn't have to be here, and I appreciate you being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, it's always fun to be on the show.
Now, guys, this is going to be one of the more laid-back episodes we've ever had of Coding 101, just because I didn't want to give us a format. I didn't want to make this a goal-driven show. I really want this to be about three guys who program a lot, who make a living out of stuff like this, and just go through some of the topics that we've heard from our friends and our folks and our fans in the Google Plus group off of Twitter. Lou, are you down for some of that?
I'm totally down for that, yeah.
All right. Now, this first question actually is something that I get a lot both on This Week in Enterprise Tech and on Coding 101, and that's from people who are looking at how they get into the field. Now, on TWiT, they're always talking about certificates. Should I take certificates? Should I get myself into a course so that I can get certified for CCNA or A+, or whatever it might be? Will that help me get into my dream job? I hear the same thing from people who want to program. People who have been watching our episodes since the beginning have been saying, I think I have a knack for this. I think I actually could do this for a living. But now they want to know how to make the next step. Patrick, let me start with you. What advice would you give to someone who is just breaking into programming, who finds that after the first couple of weeks, they've really got a knack for thinking like a programmer, and now they want to make it a career?
I think first and foremost, you need to understand the programming language itself, and a certificate says to potential employers that you understand it, but it doesn't necessarily give you that understanding. It's just like a test to prove that you understand it. And so you can have the understanding without having a cert, but having the cert, if you're especially looking for a job, that's where it really comes in handy.
Right. Lou, I did have someone contact me on Twitter, and it was interesting because he was saying, I've just put myself on the market, and I have some potential jobs, but I don't know how to price myself. I think that's especially to someone who's just starting off. You don't want to price yourself out of the contract, but at the same time, you don't want to price so ridiculously low that people are looking at you and going, obviously he doesn't know what he's doing or what his talent is worth. Is that something you've ever run into?
Yeah, so when once you're starting out, you got to. I mean, it's tough because there's a lot of sites out there like Freelancer and Upwork that have these places where you can go post yourself, like and basically tell them what you can do, and you know, and you can even put bids in for you can actually do work for a specific amount of bid amount. And so it's tough because you don't really know what the industry standard pricing for something like that. If you know what you're doing, you know, what are people charging for that type of work? So sometimes it's tough. You can go to these sites and people can really, you know, outdo you when it comes to pricing. They might charge like, you know, $10 an hour when the normal rate might be going $150 an hour.
Right.
So it's really a tough thing to do. But again, as you learn and understand the industry and what the scope of your knowledge is, you it's easy to kind of pinpoint where you need to be when it comes to pricing wise.
Lou, how much influence do you have with the hiring decisions as you bring people into that department? Do you let HR handle that and you just deal with them as programmers, or do you ever actually look over the resumes and the possible candidates and then help with that decision?
Oh, I do both. Yeah, I do. I review resumes and let them know if we want to even interview them or not. And when they come in, I do the interviewing. I give reviews, and sometimes I'm even the last person in the interview, so I can say, hey, if there's a couple pluses, a couple minuses, I do that, you know, basically decide on whether they make it or break it, kind of, so to speak. So it's kind of an interesting process to go through an interview because you start with, you know, the technology interview. We also do problem solving. We do lots of different things when it comes to hiring somebody who's an engineer.
I want to get back to that because I do want to talk about what things you look for in those resumes, because I think people will be very interested in finding out what they should put in the resumes. But Patrick, let me go to you first and ask you this. Contract work is something that people in this field both love and hate. Yeah. Especially early on in the career, a contract is fantastic. It means you get to work when you want to work, only when you want to work. You get a large sum of money and you're responsible for it. And it always seems as if many of those really good contractors eventually end up as salaried positions.
Often, yes.
Tell me, what's your experience with that?
Well, I've done a lot of contract work, and I liked doing the work because that's obviously what I do now, and I like programming. But the part I didn't like was having to go out and find the work and having to manage the relationship between myself and the company. I just wanted the project, I'll work on it, and push it out. And to have to, you know, to do all of the roles as a contractor. I built some websites for various companies, and I'd have to present the website, I'd have to do the billing, and the billing part, that's not fun. I mean, I just want to code.
Yeah.
And so eventually I got tired of it and moved on and found a salary job.
That's surprising because I've heard that story so many times, which was, it was fun to contract at the beginning, but then I actually started having life responsibilities.
Yeah.
And, you know, running your own business is a hassle, and here's a steady job. I know I'm going to get this paycheck every single month. I'm actually working less than I would if I did a contract. I mean, it's more consistent, but it's less intense. I get benefits, and so a lot of the really, really bright contract folks will end up signing a contract for full employment.
Yeah, and contracting was hard because you've got periods where it's very intense.
Feast
and
famine.
So much time doing all the work, and then that's done, and now what do I do with all my free time? I got to go find more clients and just find more clients. And
Patrick, were you self-employed, or were you employed by a company that did contracting work?
I was self-employed for a few years. It was just as the dot-com bubble burst, so it got really hard to find new clients.
Wait, let's do a quick episode of Before You Contract here. The pros and the cons of being a contract worker. Give them to me.
The pros, I set my own hours, I set my own price, and I work on projects that I want to work on. The cons, I have to do all the non-programming stuff I really don't want to do, whether it's finding the clients, the billing, and just presenting to the clients, trying to sell them. I'm not a salesperson. I've never been a salesperson, and I really didn't like that part.
Lou, did you ever do contract work?
Oh, yeah. I did tons of it. Hmm. Yep. So I did work for especially in college, I did work for Ford through a company called Dana Corporation. I did a lot of hardware work for them. In fact, I have a couple patents through them doing contract work. And it, you know, it's like Patrick said, it's not easy because one, you don't really know what to charge, and you don't exactly know, you know what they're how they're if they're going to take your work as good or bad, or how to go through the review process. But once I started to learn that, you know, I started to learn, well, you know, charge for the project, but if they want to make any changes, charge for that. And if they want to make, if they want support thereafter, charge for that. And so then I started ensuring that I had a true flow of money coming through. But then I hit the same block that you were talking about, Padre, where you were saying, hey, I want a steady job. I want a steady paycheck, and I want to go and I want to get benefits and all this stuff. And so I thought, you know what, it's time for me to make a change. And that's when I switched over to a company like Microsoft.
All right, let's start with that first question, because all three of us have had to deal with that, which is, since we ran our own businesses, we represented ourselves. At some point, we had to do that very first, this is how much I'm going to sell my time for. And I was fortunate. I actually had someone I trusted very, very much. And he guided me through everything. He said, this is how much you should charge. This is how you should set it up. This is the front end. This is the back end. So not a lot of people get that. What was your first experience like, Lou?
So my first experience in college, you know, you learn, you go through and you learn, like, you know, operating systems and developing, you know, developing web services and, you know, digital logic and all these very low level things that don't really apply to normal world kind of things. And so when you go, and I actually got the opportunity to go and do internships for companies like Intel and actually Anheuser-Busch and some other companies. And I started to learn about the industry standards in these different industries. And then so when I started to get contract work, I kind of knew, you know, where I needed to start, where I needed to look to understand those technologies. So that actually helped, you know, with that. But people who are just starting out, who are like, hey, I want to do this one thing, it's tough to find those resources and understand really what the industry is working on or using at that point.
But how did you find your price? I mean, what was the thing that told you, this is too much, this is too little, this is probably where I want to be?
You know, it's all about time. So like if a project came along, like Patrick talked about web development, if it was like I did, there was a company that came along, there was a company called Polaris who does, you know, the snowmobiles and so on, and they wanted an internal Facebook system built. And it was just when Facebook was coming out, and they wanted their own internal one for built off their HR system. And then, so I was thinking, that's going to be a big job because Facebook's not an easy thing to build out. And so, you know, I gauged it by how much time it was going to take me. That's it. That's the company. Yeah. So they wanted to do internal Facebook for their HR system. I'm sure by now they probably have one, but they're out of Minneapolis. And so they wanted to build an internal one. And so, I thought, this is going to take me months for me to build this out, if not, you know, longer than that. And so what do I charge to even get a normal salary for me, an income? And so that's what I decided was the first thing, is to make sure that I could pay my bills and do all that work, is I would charge just a normal everyday salary that would get me past my bills. And I think that was the good start. But then, you know, I found out that it was taking a lot more of my time because people would change things on me, and then they would want more support on things, and things would break, and I'd have to go there, actually travel there. And so then I found out, you know what, I'm going to start charging for travel, and I'm going to start charging for my extra time outside the delivered product. So I started understanding that. And so the price came from the fact that I was doing beyond the normal work. So I charged extra beyond what I charged for the daily hour wage that I did for the actual project. And so then I just kind of went along with it there and that. And they just took it. And they just ate it up. So I think maybe I was still even cheaper. As they started to eat it up, they're like, oh, that's fine. I started to notice that they were eating it up pretty quickly, so I started raising the prices on things, and I started noticing.
That's the worst feeling. I had that on a couple of my first jobs, where I offer a price that I think, okay, you know, we'll negotiate down from here, and they go, oh, no, yeah, we'll take that. And I'm like, dang. Damn.
You started out too low.
No. But one of the things that my mentor told me was, figure out how many hours you want to work a week. Then you need to figure out, okay, those hours need to support your life. What are your expenses, your fixed cost? What is it going to actually cost for the job? What things can you charge to the company for material support? Now, whatever you charge needs to work within those parameters. You need to be paid X amount of money per hour in order to make this kind of lifestyle work. Anything above it is gravy. But if you don't take care of that basics, you said the worst feeling you're going to have is if you lock yourself into a contract and you realize 3 weeks into the contract, this is not enough for me to pay my bills. And now you have to either short shrift the project you already committed to and get another project, or you have to go to them and say, I can't complete it for what you're paying me.
Yeah.
Patrick, you had a first contract situation. What was that like?
Yeah, the first contract, I, of course, didn't know what to charge. And so I talked to a number of friends who had done similar contract work and people who had actually hired contractors doing this sort of web development I would be doing, and asked what sort of hourly rate would somebody ask for something like this. And I got a fairly wide range that was fairly low to crazy high. And so that didn't help, but at least it told me my limits. And so then I sat down, like you were saying, I made a spreadsheet that had my expenses for the last few months and figured out what my expenses would be, like down to groceries and gas, and figured out, okay, here's what I need to live. And, you know, some money for movies and, you know, have a life. And figured, okay, I want to work this many hours a week, so I should charge at least this much, and it ended up being not a whole lot. So raise that way up, because have to pay for health insurance and all that other stuff. And so, yeah, I came up with a rate, and at the rate I was getting contracts at the beginning, it was probably a lot less than other people.
Right.
And I think that might have been a problem, because some people see the low rate and they think, oh, he's really cheap. He might not know his stuff.
I want to talk about that in just a bit. Talk about, again, Lou, what you see in a contract that might raise red flags. But it's interesting. The Gem Doctor in the chat room is saying it's always easier to lower your prices than to raise them. I did have a situation very early on in my career where I way overcharged. Remember, when I started up my consulting business, they didn't exist. None of the big names were there. This idea of providing IT support and programming support was brand new. So I charged way too much, and they paid it because they didn't know better. And I got towards the end of my contract, and I realized I probably should have charged them about 40% of what I was charging them. And I went to them, and I said, you know what? This job was easier than I thought it was going to be. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you X amount of free support. It's not going to cost. I didn't have to give the money back, but I made a client for the rest of my career. They stayed with me because they remembered that. They remembered, wow, he's honest enough to tell us when he overcharged. That was actually a big thing. That taught me very early on. Look, be honest about what you think you're worth. But that one time you're honest with your client, oh my gosh, it's worth its weight in gold.
Yep. Over under promise, overachieve. It always gets customers or clients, you know, you do more than what you say you're going to do. They always, especially being honest like that, they'll always come back.
Right. But Lou, let me go back to that question. You do deal with hiring decisions, and so you get to see these resumes. When you see the applicant pool, is one of the things you're looking for a realistic expectation of salary? What happens when you see numbers that are way too high or way too low?
So, you know, when you see salaries way too high, normally that just means that potentially they started in a position where it was very a niche market, where maybe they went to a company like a manufacturing place that only had one person that did that job. And so they decided to pay them a lot because it was more like a dead end place where there was no place for them to go. So I tend to see that. But that doesn't mean that they're not qualified, so that they still could be fully qualified for what they're doing their job at. If they're underpaid, sometimes they're looking for something bigger. So if they, you know, for me, when they come into Microsoft, if they're underpaid, they're looking for something bigger, that maybe there's more resources for them to learn or more opportunities for them to move around. And so I don't think, again, that's a red flag. I don't think either one of those are red flags for me when I look at somebody's resume or even asks for more salary.
So the lower salary could just be, oh, this person wants to get his foot in the door.
Yep,
he wants to make sure that he gets the position because he thinks he can parlay it into something else. That's interesting.
Exactly right.
Have you ever used that?
No, but I've seen that too, because when I worked at Monster, I'd have to interview a lot of people, and we'd get people that would come to Monster. They were familiar with our brand, and they wanted to have Monster on their resume.
Ah,
and
resume building.
A lot of people, it was obvious when they came in that they didn't plan to stay with the company, and they were just coming in to put that on their resume, and then they planned to go off and do their own thing.
There's a lot of that where you have to look at little things on the resume, like, for instance, how long were they in their last position? They might have got paid a low amount, but they might have been there for 10 years, right?
Right.
So in that case, that's a that's not a red flag, like Patrick said, where they're going to come in and just leave because they're resume building. More like they stick with their jobs for a while.
Yeah.
But if they're there for 30 days or 60 days or for half a year and they're flipping around to Apple, Microsoft, Google, then you know, yeah, they're coming here just to put it on the resume and they're moving off. So,
what was the biggest red flag for you? For me, when I was hiring, the number one red flag was length of employment. If I saw someone who was jumping constantly, I wouldn't even look at the resume because I knew that, oh, whatever you do here, you're going to take the skills I give you and then you're going to look for a better job. I want someone who I can train and will stay with me for a time that I recoup the training. For you, what would it be?
For me, I think it definitely length of employment. And also it's one of those things where you see – it's almost like somebody has too many skills where they list like every programming language known to man and they list like every technology and their jobs that they, their previous jobs or even their resume is tailored specifically to the technologies and the things that your job has. So I'm very skeptical when that happens. But the thing is, lots of these systems will pick these resumes because they do keyword searching or tokenizing of the, so you really still have to give an opportunity. But to me, I go into the interview a little bit more of a skeptic, so I tend to probe the person a little bit to understand if they really do understand all of these technologies and all of these things. So they're more of a red flag for me because somebody could figure out what the job's about, and then they know exactly what technologies and everything to put and even make up previous jobs. And so that's why we do a lot of background checks and stuff too. But again, those are red flags because, like you said, length of employment as well as, you know, just overstuffing your resume, so to speak.
My sister is a headhunter, for a technology headhunter, and she always used to tell me, she'd give me the job description, and she'd say, okay, look at our requirements, the language requirements. What is a good question I should ask for each and every single one of these languages, and what's the answer they need to give me? Otherwise, I know they have absolutely no idea how this actually works. And they use that. Headhunters will use that. They'll give you a question that sounds completely innocent, and if you don't give them the right jargon, they know he doesn't actually know what he put down on his resume. Patrick, what about you? Red flags.
Well, since I worked for Monster, I had access to the resume database. That was so much fun. I could search resumes right there, and I loved to just search for a certain misspelling. The people who could not spell shift manager, because there's an F in there. And I don't know how those people presented their resumes, because that's really awkward. But yeah, red flags. Some people seem to think that not having, like, just out of college, and what do I put? I don't have a programming job. I haven't done an internship. But I got my first job with internet.com not having done any web programming before, because I had my own websites that I was able to show off. And so that helped. And they saw what it was capable of, even though it wasn't actual work experience.
Portfolio.
But we, like I mentioned before, we had people coming to Monster that were obviously looking to just have a well-known business on their resume. And, yeah, job hopping. You know, one job for 30 days, okay, fine, that probably didn't work out so well. But when you've got a string of jobs that are just less than a year, that's really not a good sign.
Yeah, or big gaps in employment. That's also
kind I'd see those, and I'd always wonder, what happened?
Aren't you listing here?
Yeah, and I figure, okay, maybe there were layoffs. That happens to everyone, but multiple
You do have to
times,
be careful with that one, though, because sometimes women will take – pregnancy leave or something like that, and they'll be out for like a year or two.
Right.
So you do have to actually be pretty careful with that one.
But like when I've had to list gaps, I've always taken pains to make sure I explain it. Say, oh well,
yes.
I was in the seminary for 4 years, so obviously I couldn't be contracting.
Yeah, and the interviewers will notice these gaps, so if you can reassure them, that helps.
Right. When we come back, actually, Race Q in the chat room has a good question. He wants to know what both of you, because you've both had hiring experience and contracting experience, what do you think about a contractor who's been contracting for 10 years and then applies for a permanent position? You know, does that change the game at all? But before we get there, let's go ahead and take the first break for this episode of Coding 101 to thank DigitalOcean. Now, if you are a developer, you know that at some point you're going to have to present the work that you do. In the old system, you would actually have to stand up a server, which means you'd have to buy the hardware and you'd have to set up the software and you'd have to make sure that all the security compliance was met and that you got a good colo and a good bandwidth pipes that you could use in order to make sure your service goes out to the world. Well, you could still do that today. I mean, if you had the time and the money and an immeasurable amount of patience, or you could just go to DigitalOcean.com and get yourself up and running in as little as 55 seconds. Now, whether you're an experienced code warrior or just getting started, you need flexible, reliable, and affordable hosting. And that's exactly what DigitalOcean gives you. They provide developers with droplets, which are virtual private servers that can be customized and deployed quickly to host websites, web apps, production applications, personal projects, virtual desktops, and pretty much everything else you can think of with full root access. It's for developers. They built it for them, which is why they've got over 400,000 people using it, including myself. I use DigitalOcean to stand up my projects whenever I need to test out with the real-world traffic or maybe open it up for a limited beta. I've even got a couple of droplets that are running production applications today for the different organizations that I work for. And I got to tell you, it's wonderful to be able to start with just a few users and scale it up, not just in one place, but around the globe. You get to choose your OS, Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, CoreOS, and FreeBSD. A one-click install lets you quickly deploy popular apps like Django, Docker, Drupal, LAMP, GitLab, MediaWiki, Node.js, WordPress, Ghost, Magneto, OwnCloud, Ruby on Rails, and more. Now, their servers are powerful. We're talking about 20 CPU hex-core machines with dedicated ECC memory and RAID SSD storage, 640 gigabytes of SSD storage space, 64 gigabytes of memory, which means it's highly scalable. You can start with a single droplet on just a CPU core and then move it up as your demands rise. Oh, auto backups are also very important, and DigitalOcean is great for that because it lets you snapshot, clone, deploy, and resize the droplets as you grow. You can also deploy in servers around the world with gigabit speeds and 99.99% uptime, including dedicated IPs for those people who really need fine DNS control. They give you a web console access with HTML5, SSH, SFTP, and KVM-VNC, and they've got an active community, which means you're going to find people like yourself, developers, programmers, IT people, and get the help that you need whenever you run into an issue. Now, DigitalOcean has incredibly affordable and straightforward pricing, which is what I like. I like straight shooters. They start at just $5 per month, and there's also hourly pricing, which drops the price down below a penny per hour. But you know what? You don't have to take my word for it. You should start on your own. And the way we're going to do that is by giving you an offer so you can start for free. That's right. Start your own SSD cloud server for nothing. Visit DigitalOcean.com and create an account. Once you confirm your email and account information, go to the billing section and enter the promo code C101. That's C101 and get a free $10 credit. That's plenty to get started, plenty to get deployed, plenty to get your SSD cloud server up in less than 55 seconds and get back to what you're good at doing. That's DigitalOcean.com, DigitalOcean.com. And once you sign up, enter the code C101 in the billing section for a $10 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Coding 101. Let's get back to the question. Lou, Patrick, you've got someone. You've got a resume coming across your desk. You've seen someone who, impressive resume. They've been gigging for 10 years. They've got some nice companies listed on the resume. They've got all the right languages. Is there any stigma attached to someone who goes from that to saying, you know what, I would like a permanent position now?
No, I think if somebody is working out, especially if they've been with that company, they've been contracting for that company, I think the company would probably love to have them come on full time. And I know we've tried to hire Russell several times, and no, he wants to stay a contractor. So
Lou, I mean, I remember for me, if someone was a successful contractor for a number of years, that normally tells me that they were pretty good at their job. I mean, people who are horrible, horrible programmers or horrible, horrible IT people, they can't contract for 10, 20 years. They contract once or twice. They have big gaps in their employment while they try to do something else, or they're trying to hide the disasters that they had. And so most of the time, not only will I not red flag them, but I will prefer those people. Oh, you're muted.
Yeah. All right. So it all what I was saying is it all depends that, you know, do you work for a contracting company? Because there are some really large ones out there that you that people get jobs with, and then they, you know, they get put on projects and they get pulled off projects, put on other projects, and they just want to get out of that environment. And then there's are where they just do their self-employed. And I think the one that you're talking about is more around the self-employed, where they do that work successfully for a long time, and then they just want some more stability, some better benefits, and then they move, and then maybe, like you said, they want the resource of a large company, and so they move to doing that. And I never red flag those types of people. The ones that I do red flag are sometimes the ones that work for contracting companies, because I, over the last 11 years I worked at Microsoft, I've had many experiences with contracting companies that they're terrible. Like, their people that they hire are terrible. They just hire for the headcount than they do hire for the skill. And, you know, you end up missing dates on projects because of it. But then on the other flip side, I found some really good people that work as employees for that company that are amazing. We end up hiring them full time. So, but it's tend to be sometimes rare for that, because, you know, again, they hire for the numbers and they do hire for the skill. So when you're standalone, like self-employed, I say, yeah, that's definitely not a red flag. But when you work for a company like that, sometimes it's you have to make sure you do more research.
Right, right. Let's flip it around, because we will get more of a second type of want-to-be programmer than we will of that first type, the contractor who's been gigging forever and now wants to take a permanent position. And JJ to the 4884 puts his finger right on it, which is, I get a lot of people who are fresh out of college. This may be their first position. Now, I didn't have to go through this because my IT experience predates my education. I started in the Silicon Valley. But I know there's a lot of people who maybe they have an internship under their belt. They probably have no real practical experience, no real gigging experience, no real contract experience. Now they want to get into the field, and they're coming up against all the people who were contractors or who have practical experience, or who had a really good internship. And for a lot of those people, it can feel impossible to break into the industry.
It's a tough place to be. I think for me, I'll give you an example. So, like, what I was telling JJ to the 4884 was that he said, you know, I'm going for comp sci, but how do I get, I don't go to school to a big school. How do I get myself known? How do I get myself, like you said, comparably against these other people? And I think the first thing is, if you're in a smaller school, yeah, some of these companies like Apple and Google, they might look to the larger schools that focus on comp sci or other things like Berkeley and, you know, Harvard and these places. But, you know, if you want to get yourself easily, you know, in the door and just into an interview, is, you know, be the person that does the side projects and posts them online, goes to functions that maybe these companies offer. Like, you know, if there's trade shows, go to the trade shows, be part of the coding hackathons, all of these things. Put yourself in that space, and you could put that on your resume. It's, again, it's a resume building event. And they see that you're part of that. And so then, even if you're part of a small school, you're getting involved and they can see your skills and see your capabilities. And posting your stuff online is even better. I knew a guy, he went to a real tiny school in Texas, and he, you know, had computer science, he had a theology degree, he had all these strange degrees, but he was never...
Hey, wait a minute. Yeah, I had that.
I'm just saying that he was never taken seriously because he had, you know, all these different degrees all over the place. You know, like, you know, he had a bunch of other degrees other than that. I don't even remember what they are, English degree and other things. And when he applied to software companies, he was never taken seriously. So what he started doing is doing side projects, doing hacks, and you do maker type stuff, posting all of it online. And then when it came to his resume, he just gave a URL and said, go here and check it out. And people would. And sure enough, he started getting, you know, he ended up working for Valve Software. So, I mean, wow. You just have to give yourself, it's basically taking the opportunity, taking initiative.
And we said it before, but it really is, it's portfolio. Build yourself up something that when you have an interview, when you have a gig, you can say, I created this. That always helps.
Yeah, contributing to open source projects.
Oh, yeah,
is another
that's huge.
Big one. Yeah, I've actually been asked on interviews if I've contributed to any open source projects, and I had to say no.
But that's big.
I keep all my code.
Said, no, I've submitted this, and it's been peer reviewed, and, you know, they accepted.
Yeah.
That's huge. If you can say, I submitted a creation of mine, and it was vetted by dozens, hundreds, thousands of other programmers, and they judged it worthy to be part of the project.
Yeah.
That's golden. That's a golden ticket.
Yeah. Well, guys, I hate to interrupt, but I'm kind of in that position where, like, if I wanted to show off these sort of things, like, would GitHub be a good place? Or, like, I don't know.
GitHub is the place.
I played with Code Academy, and I've done, you know, I've done Lynda kind of tutorials and stuff. I mean, are these kind of things that you would kind of list together on a website, you know, if you wanted to kind of show, you don't have any experience in the industry, but you've been trying to like do your own projects, show off stuff. Like, is that kind of the way you would do it?
Yeah. I think that's a good way to do it. But I think another way is, because anybody can do that, right? I can go and start a GitHub project and it could just be hello world, right?
Right.
So I think the thing is, you want to do things that, you know, people are using, people will contribute to. Maybe you could contribute to their project. Mm-hmm. You know, again, going to things like, like I said, maybe Facebook offers some function or hackathon you can go through if you're interested in doing that type of work, and you go and involve yourself in there, and you can post that you did part of the project for that. I mean, these are bigger things, you know, than just one thing. Some people get an idea and they go to GitHub and they start the idea, and people pick up on it and say, wow, this is a great library. I'm going to contribute, or I'm going to use it. And so people start using it, and you can show usage capability or download numbers from GitHub. And that also helps. But if, like I said, sometimes just posting on those sites don't actually help.
Yeah. Or like trying to finish an app and following through and have it submitted to like a app store, like Google
Absolutely.
Play or something like that.
Yeah. If that also helps. If there's an app that they can go and download on their own phone to check out and see how well you've made it, that is a big help, because they can check out your code right there.
Right.
And that could be good and sometimes bad. Because sometimes you can think your app is awesome, and you're like, here's my app. And then they download it, like, this is a terrible app. But, you know, that's personal experience right here.
Yeah.
But again, if you got good reviews and people are using it and you're improving on it, and maybe even charge for it, and you can give them, you know, numbers, how much you've made off of it. Because, you know, the fart apps can make millions of dollars, but they're terrible apps, right? So, I mean,
sure. So you're saying don't make a fart app?
No, make a fart app, okay. But don't put your name on it.
Okay.
Exactly. Phew. Just put Cranky Hippo. We'll be good.
All
right. You know, actually, one of the trends that I've heard about is using Kickstarter. I've seen people get jobs from Kickstarter. They start a project, and even if it fails, as long as the project was very well set out, the goals are very concrete, and the demo was good, I've seen people say, yeah, this Kickstarter failed, but it did get a little bit of heat, it got a little bit of support, and people actually liked it. And again, it's something concrete that they can look at and say, oh, this guy is not just a carbon copy coder. He actually has an idea for what he wants, and he knows how to get to that point, which I find really good. Let me ask another question. Here's the slightly darker side of both coding and the IT world, and that is, aside from the first time I started a business way, way back when, I think every single gig that I have ever gotten has been because of somebody I know. It's word of mouth. It's friends. It's people that you've worked with who will recommend you for a job. I found that network was the most important thing in my gigging life, in my contract life. Have you seen anything? Have you had a similar experience? Let's start with you, Lou.
Yeah, I think that's why I was saying get yourself involved, because you'll end up running into somebody, you know, whether it's a hackathon or it's a trade show or maker fair, where you're just really interested in the project and you show them yours, or you get to know somebody and you make an acquaintance. And, you know, I've actually had the best of luck, more luck. In fact, that's how I got a job at Microsoft, is I knew somebody who knew the work that I did, and they said, wow, you really fit this position, and maybe we can get you an interview, that kind of thing. So I got an opportunity there. I got an option to get there. I think, you know, growing your network and getting yourself out there, sometimes it's scary, but it will really help your opportunity. So then you feel more comfortable, because you can be in a job over here and say, okay, I'm starting to dislike this, but I know this one person that maybe I can go do this other thing. So you feel a little bit more comfortable in your daily work job because you have that network.
What about you, Patrick? Because it sounds unfair. To someone who's just starting out, it sounds like, wait a minute, I don't have access to that. I don't have an old boys network. And it sounds like it's a dishonest way to get a job. But, I mean, those are relationships you have to nourish. It's not like, I know these people and therefore I got the job. It's these people know me and they know I can work.
Yeah. Out of all the jobs I've had, only one, I didn't know anybody at the company when I went in. That was Monster. I just applied on Monster and got the... but yeah, even my first job out of college at internet.com, I had worked with somebody at my college's computer help desk whose brother worked at this company, and they were looking for somebody, and so I got hooked up that way. And so yeah, networking is huge. And even when you leave a company, you don't want to burn those bridges because you may be working with one or all of those people again sometime. I went back to Monster.
Yeah.
And then I left internet.com a month before they went out of business, but I ended up working with some of those people again. And so it's good to maintain those relationships.
Absolutely. It's funny, in the social era, every once in a while you'll see one of those fantastic stories of, I wish I could do this. They tell off their coworkers, they tell off their bosses. And I'm thinking, yeah, that might feel good to get all that frustration out, but at the same time, did you just destroy 5 years of bridge building? Did you just destroy all those relationships? Because those people will never recommend you for a job. They're going to remember the time you blew up.
And anybody who sees that video is not going to hire you.
Exactly. You know, it's maybe actually, I think maybe Lou might have some insight on this. This may be a multi-billion dollar industry, but it still feels like a very small group of people, in that everybody talks and everybody will find out who your social circle was and what the story is about you. So you can't really afford to be a jackass, right?
Absolutely. That's I agree with 100%. It's tough because unless you're, I mean, I know lots of jackasses in the business, and the only reason why they're still looked upon is because they are the best at what they
do. So you can be a jackass if you are absolutely the prima donna expert. But if you're not, you're done.
Yep. I think even though you're the best at what you do and you're jackass, the problem is people don't want to work with you.
Right.
They want to ask you questions and pick your brain, but they don't want to work with you. And so, you know, I've worked in companies and even my own company where, you know, I have to go ask somebody a question. I know they know the answer, but I have to sift through all the BS that they give me, right? And it's a tough process to go through because I know I'm going to get the answer at it. But I only go to them as a last resort. But if you're really good at what you do and you're a nice person, you're good, easy to work with, and you're a team player, team builder, then everyone's going to want you. Everyone's going to want to work with you. You know, it's the ones that, you know, are, you know, oh, I'm going to help you, but then you never help them. I mean, right. those are the types of people that are like, those were instant bridge burners type of thing.
When we come back, I do want to go on to the question that we're going to get most often, and that is, well, okay, I get this. I understand bridge building, relationships, get my work out there, build a portfolio. But now let's get down to the brass tacks of what should I learn? What languages should I go for? What projects should I be involved with? We're going to talk a little bit about that. But first, I do want to take another break to thank the second sponsor of this episode of Coding 101. Now, this is a subject that is near and dear to app developers, because even if you're doing it out of the passion and out of the fact that you just love what you do, at some point you're going to have to worry about getting paid, which is why you're going to want to go with Braintree.com. Now, Braintree is the easiest way, the best way to add payments to your mobile app. If you're thinking about developing for iOS or for Android or for Windows Phone, at some point you're going to need a way to monetize it. And that's what Braintree lets you do, in a nice, easy, secure way. It's not like a previous solution that would require you to make an arrangement with a payment processor and maybe work on the back-end code and make sure that your security was up to snuff. Braintree takes care of all that. You focus on programming, and they will allow you to use their SDK, their V.0 SDK, and 10 lines of code to integrate all the most popular ways to pay into your application. Now, developers, they've got you. Don't worry about taking days and days to integrate your payments. With Braintree, it's done in minutes, and they'll actually have someone sit with you while you do the integration to make sure that you do it right. They'll let you accept PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, cards, and more, all with that simple, single integration. The Braintree code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients. It's also got SDKs in 7 languages, including .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. They've got elegant code, and this is what I like, clear documentation. This is not a black box. They tell you exactly how the code works, exactly what the SDK is using, so you can have complete confidence when you integrate it into your app that it will do exactly what it says it's going to do. Braintree gives you an easy way to accept multiple payment types with that one integration. If you're thinking at all about accepting Venmo, PayPal, Apple Pay, or anything else, really, I gotta ask, why would you consider anybody else? With that Braintree V.0 SDK, you can add your 10 lines of code and get back to programming your app. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/coding. That's BraintreePayments.com/coding. And we thank Braintree for their support of Coding 101. All right, guys, million-dollar question. This is the one that people always come down to. After they've listened and they've absorbed your knowledge and they understand that they have to treat people right and they actually have to have a passion for programming, they say, all right, I got all that, but I can only learn one or two languages at a time. Where do I focus?
Well, it depends what you want to do. I mean, if you want to do iOS apps, obviously you've got two choices. So, if you want to do Android apps, if you want to do websites or OS programming, it depends on what you want to do, and that kind of narrows it down. And then,
but how much of that is driven by where the money is? I mean, we all know, we've all read the reports. The money is in iOS, and you may be the greatest Android developer of all times, but you're going to get really bummed out when your masterpiece of an app, which connects people to all the knowledge in the world, is outsold by the fart app. Right?
Sure.
I mean, that's depressing.
Well, but do you want to do
Flappy Bird?
Do you want to do coding that you enjoy, or do you want to do it just for the money? I mean, that's a question
for
everybody individually.
Wait a minute. That's a straw man. Lou. I mean, yeah, it's good to say I want to do what I want to do where my passion lies, but at some point you're taking care of the family, right?
Yeah, I think it's two things. Like, I think there's one part of it where you know, if you're still in college, you don't have a family and you're targeting something specific. You know, what I was telling a bunch of people in the chat room was, you know, if you start to do side projects and you start to really enjoy them and you become really good at them, sometimes those are niche markets, the areas where you can go and make a ton of money because not a lot of people do that work and you're actually really good at it. So if you're the best Android developer, you can charge a company like, I don't know, some company in New York City that wants an app for their retail store, a lot of money to build Android app, even though they're offering it for free. So, I mean, even though the quote unquote money is in the iOS, it's because they make money on selling the apps. It doesn't mean you can't make money developing for other platforms, right? So I think, yeah, but at the end of the day, it is about feeding the family. So if you have a family, sometimes stability is where it's at. And that's why working for a company that's going to give you that steady paycheck, you know, if you have a specific skill, is going to help out.
But at the same time, I understand what you're saying. I mean, you don't want to burn yourself out making an app you absolutely loathe just because it's paying the bills.
Yeah. So anybody who does programming probably has a set of languages that they are familiar with and enjoy. So you don't have to pick just one. Like, if you love Fortran, you're probably going to have a really hard time finding a job. But hopefully there's something else you also like that they're hiring for.
Right. And you know what? This is something that's been recognized by large companies. Google, Microsoft, and Apple, they all do that part of your time you spend on another project, right? It's a refresher. It's saying, okay, yeah, we understand that not all of you may be absolutely in love with the projects that we've assigned you, so we want to give you 10%, 15%, 20% of your time to do something you love or something you want to learn. That's sort of the institutional simulacrum of doing the thing you love, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Microsoft does this thing where they have this thing called the Maker Garage or the Garage, and then they have this hackathon coming up in a couple of weeks where they offer these opportunities for you to really shine and put up your project somewhere and advertise what you've done outside of your normal job. Like, people who are, you know, I work on CRM, people are doing like Cortana integrations and building, building machines, you know, building drones and all these different things using the 3D printers and all this different stuff. And, you know, it really kind of gets your juices flowing and gets you really interested in what you're doing, even though maybe your daily job is not the most exciting thing in the world. Plus, it keeps your knowledge up, too, around the industry standards and some of the new stuff that's coming out. That's really important for a company to do, because if you go to your daily job every day, day in, day out, like, I know a guy who works at a financial institute who's a developer there, and he just hates his job because he goes in and it's the same thing every day. And he has to do the same exact thing, and he can't move up, he can't move down, he can't move sideways. And so you get stuck. But if you have a company that offers the opportunities, it's definitely the place to be.
Okay, so let me ask the correlator to that is, how do you refresh yourself? I mean, Lou, you've got the garage, you've got the hackathon, but how do you step away from a project that you don't despise because it's paying the bills and it's keeping your family taken care of, but you know, you kind of long for something else. What do you do? And I'm going to ask you next, Patrick, but what do you do to make sure that you maintain that flame? Because we've talked about this in past episodes of Coding 101. It's not enough to say, I'm going to get paid. At some point, it has to be a passion for you to solve problems with your code.
So industry has helped those types of people out. One thing you'll notice is, you know, for me, if I want to go learn about something else, or I want to, you know, do some side projects, there's always places like the show, particularly, that offer opportunities, insights into the world of the industry that help you kind of get places and know what you need to learn. And so, like, you know, for me, I've kind of found the holy grail when it comes to that, where if I want to do business software, and I just go to places like, I'll go to, you know, Oracle.com or Apple.com or Google.com or your GDC to figure out different places for me to go and learn what the industry is using, what people are starting to use. You know, like if I wanted to learn CNCNA, I go to ciscopress.com and understand what the new standards are, and maybe I go learn those things. You know, if I want to learn about Oracle and technology, if I want to learn about Microsoft technology, Channel 9, these different places you go to where it's the next best technology, the next best thing. And these companies do tons of millions of dollars worth of research to figure out where the industry is going. So why not use those resources to learn these things, and you'll already be ahead of the game. And so that's kind of the key, because you can go and learn, like Patrick said, Fortran, but you'll notice there's no Fortran on this site, right? but you'll notice there's C++, Android development, and you know ASP.NET and C# and Java and Python, all these different things are on this site and to learn, and they'll teach you these things, Windows, you know, universal apps. I mean, and these are just things that they know, that the companies know, that they've put millions of dollars in researching, know that the industry might go to. And so putting your effort into that is not going to be wasted.
I have to point out the fact that this is late. So we're doing a pre-record. So we're almost at 8 o'clock p.m. And the chat room is still very active. And there's a lot of stuff I can't actually mention on the stream, but it's hilarious. You've got Liquacious saying, you know, it's painful to be left in the dust by a fart app. You've got people who are saying, yeah, this is why you don't have families if you're a programmer. We've got CR1 who's saying, look, punch cards are an untapped sector in programming.
But
for you, Patrick, what is your way of refreshing?
Well, I actually had to do that because when I worked at Monster, I was doing development on the website, and then they kind of split the department. And since I was the only one in the company that understood how the ad server worked, I went with the ad team and went into ad operations, which then got put into sales. So I actually worked in the sales department, which was so depressing.
And you were in the sales department and forever the ad inner workings.
Yeah, I was the ad guy. My ad's not serving. How come? And I'd have to go look. The most coding I could do there was JavaScript for an ad and trying to tell people, explain why this version of Flash isn't working and that version had to be used. And I had to get back to programming. And so what I had to do was I maintained my own website in my free time on the side, and so that later on when I was looking for a job, I was saying, well, I want to get back into programming. I can't really show you anything that I've done at Monster because I've done custom reports, but those are confidential and they're internal. But I've done this public website and I've done all the coding on it, and so being able to maintain the code myself and keep up to date on developments and APIs and development kits, it really helped. And I would go into interviews and ad operations, what? And it's like, no, I'm not looking for a job in ads. I want to get back into programming. That's why I'm leaving. Oh, okay. And so, definitely maintaining my own stuff on the side was a huge help.
Well, gentlemen, we're coming to the end of our time here. But I do want to open it back up to either of you to talk a little bit more about tips, hints, secrets that you want to offer to people who are trying to get into this. Because, I mean, really that's what this entire episode has been about. But for those folks who feel like this is something they could do if they could just get that first contract or if they could just get known, if they could just have their work put out in front of people, what advice would you want to give to somebody like that?
I would say definitely team up with other people, because you have the networking aspect, and if you can collaborate with other people on a project, you can build something together, learn from each other, and then you have something to show when you're on a job interview. And you can say, look, we built this great thing. Check it out. Tell us what you think. And I would love to do something like this for you. And but being able to have actual proof, you know what you're doing, something like that is perfect to have in an interview.
Lou, what about you? What are the secrets of working for Microsoft?
I think, like I said before, I mean, I've said it a couple times, is, you know, involve yourself, get yourself out there. Patrick knows, he goes to lots of trade shows and conferences and stuff. You meet a lot of different people there. And if you're not afraid to ask questions, you're not afraid to go to different talks and ask the hard questions and start to network and learn about different people's projects. And like you said, even get involved with their projects. That gets you interested and gets your name out there, gets you networking. And that's the secret, is just get enthused about what you're doing, get involved. Even I know a guy who started, you know, really interested in browser engines, and he contributed to Mozilla's Firefox and ended up getting a job with Mozilla. So, I mean, these types of things is you go where you're interested and you get yourself involved. Don't be afraid to ask the hard questions if you want to understand something, how somebody's doing something. If you're interested in their work, they will be sometimes interested in you. And I think these are all important things that will get you your foot in the door, no matter what school you went to or what background you have. If you are passionate about that, what you're doing, and you get yourself involved and get yourself out there, there's always opportunity.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being part of this episode of Coding 101. This was something different. I wanted to do something that wasn't, you know, a regular wildcard episode. This is obviously not a programming episode. I have actually really enjoyed this. I think we're going to do this more often. Every once in a while, we're just going to get some people who program. Of course, we could always have back Patrick, but let's get some other interesting programmers and just speak really frankly about how do you take this knowledge that we're trying to give you on Coding 101 and actually turn it into something more, turn it into a career, turn it into a contract. Would you, both of you, be interested in doing this every once in a while?
Oh, absolutely. This was great.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's great. Fun.
It's different. And, you know, it's a nice way to sort of cleanse the palate.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
And who knows? Perhaps you can all send your resumes to Lou at loumm@microsoft.com. And he'll get your foot in the door over there.
Outlook.com.
LouMM@Outlook.com. But gentlemen, if you could please now tell the audience where they can find your work. Patrick, I want to start with you because you've got some very exciting things happening in your life, and I want to give you as much plug time as possible.
Well, I'm not sure what thing you're referring to, but I do have my website, fancons.com, where I list fan conventions, which is comic conventions, anime conventions, sci-fi conventions, fantasy, etc. If you're looking for a convention where you can geek out with other nerds, that's the place to find it, fancons.com. And also, my wife's book is out, Awkward.
Yes, that's the big, big news.
It's now available in stores everywhere, so get a copy of this. There's no code in it, but she did use technology to make it.
It's very geeky. It's very geeky.
Yeah, there's geocaching and there's a science club and
I ordered my copy. Go to Amazon.com or support your local bookstore.
Barnes & Noble, your local comic shop should have it. If they don't, ask them to get it.
Patrick Delahanty, you'll find him here on the Twit TV network. He lurks in the background, and his wife makes some incredible art, incredible cosplay. She was the one who helped you with making Baby Groot, and
yes.
She'll be with you at Dragon Con. Do you know what you're cosplaying yet?
Yes.
Oh, okay, got it. No? That's fine.
We have received a helmet in the mail, so that'll be there.
All right, now I'm gonna have to sneak in and find out what you're doing.
Yep.
Lou Maresca, my super special. What did I call you at the beginning of the episode? What was your title this time?
Sharknado Code Monkey.
Our Sharknado Code Monkey. Actually, we just wasted that. That should have been for the next episode. But of course, he is a senior software development lead at Microsoft. He works in their CRM department. Lou, can you tell the folks where they can find you and your work?
Absolutely. So you can always find me, LouMM, on Twitter. And, of course, all my work at Microsoft is found at crm.dynamics.com.
Fantastic. Gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure to share the field of coding with you. I'm Father Robert Ballasier. That's Lou Maresca. That's Patrick Delahanty. And this has been Coding 101. Hey, Lou, let's say it. End of line.
End of line.